I think that the orchestra industry is, we've made them feel like they don't belong. So we've created all these rules that are designed to make people feel stupid when they come into the hall.
We've created a bunch of rules in classical music that are fictional.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guests today are conductor Brad Thatchuk and guitarist Steve Thatchuk, founders of Gravel Museum Music, which is dedicated to preserving the rich legacy of rock music in the concert hall by presenting it with the full symphony orchestra and dynamic arrangements. Both Brad and Steve have music PhDs as well as some big-time credentials. Brad is the music director of the Niagara Symphony Orchestra, the conductor for the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra's BPO Rock Series, and a lecturer at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. Steve is the head of guitar studies at Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles and has appeared in recital as a chamber musician and soloist with orchestras throughout North America and Europe to critical acclaim. Gravel Museum shows include the music of Phil Collins and Genesis, Classic Rock Radio, Deep Purple Rising, and Symphonically Hip. In the past, they've also done projects like Steve Hackett, Genesis Revisited for Band and Orchestra, Tribute to the Grateful Dead, and Dave Mason with Symphony Orchestra. During the interview, we talked about how the brothers went from classical to rock and back to classical again, how working in a record store was so important later in their careers, the massive prep time required for a show, how Steve worked his way through graduate school by winning guitar competitions, and much more. I spoke with Steve and Brad from their studios via Zoom. I want to start with the Gravel Museum Orchestra, only because it's a very unique entrepreneurial venture that you're doing. So tell me how that came about.
I guess, want me to start, Steve? Or?
Sure.
Yeah, so actually, at its basic genesis was... And I remember it was around when Steve was getting married. I was an assistant conductor in like Fort Wayne, Indiana. And when you're an assistant conductor, it's a great job to learn on, but you also have a lot of free time. So it sounds crazy, but I was getting tired of, as an assistant conductor, you do a lot of Christmas concerts. And good arrangements for Christmas music for orchestra didn't exist. So Steve suggested, oh, why don't you learn a notation software? And so I was actually house sitting for him in Los Angeles that summer, and I didn't have many friends. So I bought a book about how to learn the software and work through it. And kind of, because I know orchestras, I stand in front of them every day. And so I learned how to orchestrate and arrange over this one summer. And then I started writing Christmas shows for some of the U.S. orchestras I was working with. And then when I moved to the Niagara region in Canada and started working with Buffalo, they started asking me to write arrangements or shows like a tribute to Stevie Wonder, or even writing arrangements with local bands. And then all of a sudden they came to me with a mammoth project, which was to write for Steve Hackett's Genesis Revisited program, which was too big for me to do alone because there's just a lot to do. And so, and my brother actually knew Steve's music much better than I did. So we decided that he would be the front end, where he would kind of do the takedown, you know, write down everything that Steve wants, correspond with Steve's music director, and give me suggestions of what to orchestrate. And since I know the orchestra really well, then I would do kind of the bigger creative part of it and assign the right instruments to the parts that he was directing me towards. And it ended up working really well that we then said, oh, and you know, I spent a lot of my career doing these with other organizations. I do rock shows with lots of orchestras. I also work with jazz artists like Chris Bode. Actually, the list goes on again. And I, when with Buffalo Philharmonic, I do 5 or 6 rock shows every year. And I have become very frustrated with the way that the shows are set up, because the we call them eye candy gigs. The drummer is so loud that and these halls aren't 5,000 seat halls, they're 2,000 seaters. So there's no way that the drummer doesn't bleed into the orchestra mics. And so you never hear the orchestra. So Steve and I said, can we do this differently? Can the orchestra be part of the texture, an integral part of the texture, as opposed to just being an eye candy backup band to some cover band there? Which was
And difficult in the context of Hackett because that was a touring band, but we got to kind of try out some of our ideas about how you can add instead of just supporting. Like, can it become another member of the band?
yeah, and we had the benefit on the Hackett tour. Now, Steve, you were in the house for like the Royal Festival Hall show. So I don't know, like in my mind, that show, even though the drums were quite loud, they were also bigger halls, so it's easier to control the separation a little bit. But in my mind, because all I have is the DVD, I'm like, oh, the balance is fantastic. But that's because there was a lot of mics and a lot of Steve. Like, could
Live,
you
it
hear?
wasn't working. Yeah, it's too.
Live, it was really difficult sometimes. So this is so then, but it's also because, and this was the frustration I came across. We were always just dropping in to back up another band because you don't want to, and I understand this. The band doesn't want to have to go back and re-rehearse everything and leave out things in the middle of a tour to accommodate one orchestra show. So we thought if we were going to do this repertoire good justice, proper justice, we were going to have to build the arrangements from the ground up with the orchestra in mind. Things like a lot of keyboard parts with string pads end up covering the actual strings in the orchestra, but you can't go to an established band and go, Roger, please stop playing those parts. You're covering my orchestrations. You can't do that.
No.
So, this in starting Gravel Museum, we got started to be able to realize this vision where the orchestra becomes the primary, actually, and integral texture because the orchestra adds a sense of event. But if you can't hear the orchestra, then there's no point in doing it. So
So
that's fine.
oftentimes we'll remove the keyboard and synthesizer line entirely and just use the orchestra, or we'll take out a guitar part and just have give it to the oboes or something, and or saxes. We've also learned over the time that saxophones are a great weapon to deploy in an orchestra context when you're doing rock music, because they're far more effective as a timbre than clarinets have been. Wouldn't you agree, Brad? Or
Yeah, we always write in some clarinet parts because most saxophone players double on clarinet. So if we require that classical texture of a clarinet, we have that available to us. But saxophones tend to pierce a little bit. I mean, saxophones are not like completely not used in orchestra, but they're a unique texture. Like you see, like in a few weeks, I'm doing Gershwin American in Paris, and there's saxophones all over that. And so you do see it even in Romeo and Juliet ballet by Prokofiev. There's a saxophone in there, so it's not completely unknown. But saxophone is an interesting weapon to deploy. We also found after years of experience that we stopped putting tuba in the orchestra because between the double bass section of the orchestra and the cello section of the orchestra and the electric bass in the orchestra and the left hand of the keyboard player in the band, having a tuba is just excessive. It's just way too much low end.
And the
So
attack is bad.
yeah, and also because they're at the back of the stage, the sound comes out a little later. So little tiny things like adjustments that we've made over time. And I think the main thing about this is that, and Steve, by the way, came up with the name Gravel Museum. And I don't know if he intended it, but it always resonated with me because what we're doing right now is we are trying to find this repertoire, great repertoire deserves. The concert hall, the symphony orchestra, has always been the place for hundreds of years where the greatest music of a generation is preserved. There is no other medium in that preserves music as effectively as the orchestra. We know the great works of the 1800s, of the 1900s, because of orchestras.
The film music of the 20s.
Yeah, and
Sure.
so I like this Gravel Museum. When I talk to my board of director, I've always considered a portion of what an orchestra does is we're a museum. And I know it's such a buzzword and everybody hates it, but we are curators of a certain point. Every orchestra decides what parts of music history
You
are.
said the C word.
Yeah, and but what parts of our orchestra, what parts of our history are going to be presented to the audience? Right? Because we can't play every work every time. So as a music director, I have to sit down and go, okay, this year we're going to take a look at a little bit of Beethoven. We're going to get a little bit of Brahms. But when you see the name Gravel Museum, okay, gravel equals rock.
Yeah.
Right. And a museum is somewhere where we preserve history. So I love the Dean Gravel Museum because I think the orchestra is the best, the concert hall is the best place for this great musical legacy to be preserved. And the only way we have proven to really preserve it outside of recordings, if you want to experience live, history is proven, you have to go to the orchestra and the concert hall.
Ultimately.
Ultimately, yeah. It takes time. Like mostly you have to be dead before that happens.
How long does it take to put a show together?
I mean, if we sat down and said that's up, because we both have careers, right? If we sat down and said we got to churn out, a 90-minute orchestra tribute show, we could probably do it in 90 days, maybe. But
90 days.
that would be 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, maybe 5, 6 hours a week. What we tend to do is we plan, like we're planning something now, and for April of 2026. And so what we'll do is we'll start picking away at it, because between both of our concert careers, it's tricky to devote that kind of time.
Yeah, I had no idea it took that long.
The process is that I just go to the recordings, and then I basically for purposes of the band playing later as well, but also for Brad, I take down everything. Like I was always inspired by, what was the name of that band that Will Smith has, the Beatles, with Fab Four?
The Fab Four, yeah.
Oh,
Yeah, so
yeah.
I was always inspired by them because they treated the source material so seriously that to do the Beatles, they would go out with like 20 people, right? And that like every single note was recreated. And so what my thing for Brad is that I'll go say, and I got, when we started working for Steve Hackett, I would go find like a Genesis tune, like Afterglow or something like that. And I would go there and I'd take every single bit that I can include. And now and that was even before I was doing drums. Now I'll go to, I can't remember one of the more complicated ones I did. Oh, I did that Styx. What was it? Come Sail Away,
Yeah.
which is involved because there's a lot of synthesizers, but like every single drum fill, every single weird accent, every single bass thing. And it's a little bit, sometimes it's a little bit too much, but it's always worthwhile to have enough authentic source material because we are trying to honor it. Because the one thing that always drove us crazy is that there would be a tribute band playing with some strings looking like they're playing whole notes behind them, right?
Yeah, and
And that didn't seem to be honoring neither the source. Well, the tribute bands usually do a great job, right? But I didn't think that there was a purpose for being in front of the orchestra, and the charts weren't honoring the source material. Because if this orchestra isn't taking Led Zeppelin seriously as something that is compositionally great, then I actually think you hear it. It's like, I think it has to be. We have to. I think arrangers, I would like, I like it when they take it seriously. And there's lots of great arrangers out there who really do. But
yeah, but you do see a lot of these orchestra shows where the band's just playing away and they go, oh, they're not gonna hear it anyway. And they go, well, it depends what region you're from. We call them either footballs or goose eggs. And it's this whole note sitting on the page and they're just going there. And so they're not really engaged. So like we have to walk a line, because I have been criticized that maybe my charts are a little too complicated, because we do have to remember that we have to do this on one rehearsal most of the time. So you
one
can't
day.
make it you in one, yeah. So you can't make it too complicated, but I like to make the parts difficult enough that the player can't tune out, that they have to be engaged. And the one thing that I do get that I really love is yeah, I just did one of my shows, one of our shows in Buffalo over the summer, and it's a show that the orchestra's done a million times, and you'd think they'd be sick of it, but they come up to me after all the time. They go, oh man, great charts, just great charts. Like they do like. I think they do appreciate when they're given something to do, because at least it's easier to, if you are sitting there on stage playing whole notes behind a really loud band for 2.5 hours,
and the drums just pounding in your ear.
yeah,
Drums
right,
pounding in your ears.
it is the longest night. Like I won't say, because I don't want to say, but there has been times when I'm doing some of these rock tribute shows with bad charts and the orchestra's tuned out,
Yeah.
and I find myself going, do I have any milk in the fridge? Like I'm honestly doing my shopping list during a concert because the music isn't that engaging to perform. The what the band's doing is amazing, but I don't really need to be there. So
Yeah. No, I hear you. I hear you. Hi, I'm Bobby Osinski, and I'm a best-selling author of several books on recording, mixing, and mastering that are considered the gold standard by many. I recently created a new resource for songwriters, artists, bands, and producers, and anyone looking to fix common mixing problems so they can get a better result, stop wasting time experimenting, and not get buried in information overload. I'm calling it the Mix Fix Playbook, 15 quick solutions to common mix problems. These fixes are well known among top mixing pros, but you probably never knew they existed. If you're looking to create mixes that stand up to what you hear on the radio, Spotify, or TV, go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. Okay, let's back up for a second. So you guys have very accomplished careers, each of you, on the more classical side of things. But yet you have chops in the rock area. Where did that come from?
Well, we started because we sucked at competitive sports. My parents finally found that we had somewhat of an aptitude for classical guitar when we were about 8 or 9. So we started learning classical guitar, and we did the exams at, like, up in Toronto, we're both Canadian, through the Royal Conservatory of Music, and we moved up through the grades to a point where we were able to go get an undergraduate in guitar performance, classical guitar performance at the University of Toronto. But we were always playing in bands from the time we were about 15 or 16. And then we were actually playing clubs by the time we were 18, which was, you know, before in Canada, before you can actually go into a bar, we were playing in bars. And there was a legendary rock club in Toronto called the Gasworks, which was immortalized in Wayne's World. And we used to play there on the weekends, and this was during the 80s, and it was a hard rock band. So we always had this thing. I experience it now, though, is like when I look back at what I didn't know back in when I was a teenager about playing rock and roll music, like the things I didn't think about that kids today have just access to, or even how amplifiers work, or, you know, or what, how do you structure something, what's a gain stage? I mean, these are all things that, like, I encounter 17-year-olds that understand gain staging, or, you know, or how to boost an amplifier. And back when we were in the 80s, we were like, I don't know, you know, you had to get there and play it.
And there was another thing, like, we had to, like, we didn't, of course we wanted to be rock stars, but the one thing we had, and this is going to be the funniest statement, but the one thing we had that none of the players on the scene had is we had classical to fall back on. And classical is actually a way more secure field.
It's so much more secure
because there is proven history that it will survive. It doesn't suffer changes of musical taste. Like, we were playing the clubs when the Nirvana switch happened, and we know it just changed everything, right?
In Toronto went from you get a guarantee to play, like, you would, if you could believe this, in Toronto in 1989, a band would make $1,000 for playing three sets. That's like 35 years ago that was possible, right? And that was a lot of money back in those days, right? And then almost overnight, Nirvana hit, and then everything went to ticket deals and pay to play, right? So there was the guarantees because of the people coming out for the 80s music. And then when that went down the grunge thing, there was then some sort of switch flipped.
They didn't trust the rock crowd, or I don't know
what happened. There should be a book about this. Like, because not only the financial model in Toronto changed as soon as the grunge thing started to take over,
and those clubs started closing.
Yeah. So Brad and I retreated back to classical music. So, like, all the way through our undergraduate, we were playing our classical concerts and learning. But at nights, Brad and I were working at a record store. Like, we were on the late night shift at a record store. And we would play on the weekends in clubs in
But we were also,
or clubs, rock clubs slash strip bars, where there
yes,
was a lot of them.
where we worked in the record stores. We worked in the two biggest record stores in Toronto, Sam the Record Man, and then when HMV moved, opened up their superstore in downtown Toronto, we were headhunted, brought over there. We worked in the classical sections.
Which is
So,
the greatest education I've ever had in music history.
and that's where I became a conductor, because I had no designs on being a conductor. I always just played guitar. And at night we would sit around and because some nights it was very dull, and we'd be putting our roommate at the time also worked with us, and he was a grad student at that point in music, Jun, and he started getting us into symphonies and Shostakovich symphonies and things like that. And back then too, there's a lot of free CDs that you could take home. There's lots and discounts. So we both acquired like orchestra CD collections in the thousands.
Yeah,
And
we had a huge record collection, both of us.
so I started every night there, I would listen to orchestra music, and I just fell in love with the thing. I had no idea how to do this. In fact, learning how to do this took me a long, long time, because I
By the
didn't.
way, this is an audio medium, Brad.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry, I'm
No,
way behind.
this video too.
Oh, okay.
So
Wait a minute.
anyway, I'm waving my arms for everybody, like kind of an ancient Harry Potter. But I didn't. That took a long time for a lot. I had a lot of things. First of all, I'm predominantly left-handed, and you have to conduct with your right hand. So I had those physical barriers and the education. And there is back then in the 90s, there was a pedigree, and there was wealth associated with being a conductor, because a lot of people's parents got them opportunities because it was hard to find an orchestra. So I didn't have those benefits. So it was a tricky thing to break through. But when I got to sitting down and learning scores, all that music was already in my ear, because after nights and nights and nights of listening to absolutely everything, and yeah, so
I would
that's
say
how.
we came after we stopped playing in the band in 1992, would you say it was around 1992 when we stopped playing in bands. We both became intensely focused on classical music to the degree that I don't think I listened to any rock music until I'm going to say 2005 or 2006. I think it was a good 14 years before I listened to rock music.
I found one exception. I was going through my CD collection last night, and I remember this because we were on our way to go with the orchestra in Cincinnati. We were on our way for a tour of Europe, and I remember we stopped in New York, and I went to Tower Records, and I bought the Van Halen 3 record, the Gary Cherone CD. And it is, when you look at my collection, it's a very conspicuous thing, because it seems to stop at, like, actually Extreme 2. It stops at three, or Extreme 3, Three Sides to Every Story. And then there's no music purchased until the one Van Halen with Gary Cherone. And then I think I bought another CD 5, 6 years later. So he is true that. Like, and then I had to catch up with a lot of bands, like one of my favorite bands, Marillion. Steve finally had to jar me back into it, because, and they're still my favorite band, but I had not seen Marillion or gone to it since I saw them in a tiny club in Cincinnati in like 97 or something like that.
My lead back into rock was actually Whitesnake was at the House of Blues in L.A. And a friend of mine was friends with one the guitar player Reb Beach, who was playing for them. So he says, "Oh, let's go see it." And I said, "Really, Whitesnake's still around?" And I said, "Yeah." And I went, and I just loved it. And then I started to kind of get curious, and I loved the House of Blues L.A. as a venue, and I miss it a lot because I really like seeing shows there. So I started going to see live gigs more regularly. So I started to kind of dip my toes back in. But I love the classical era. I mean, I did competitions. I was able to kind of pay for my graduate school through competitions. I did European competitions and Canadian competitions for about a year or two, and I won enough money to go to grad school, do my master's. And so I was pretty accomplished as a classical guitar soloist. And then I got recruited to run the guitar program at Cal State Northridge. I was playing in Florida and a bunch of people, and this is like the old days, right? Where it's like a bunch of people came to see me play with suits and came to me afterwards and said, would you be interested in running a guitar program, classical guitar program, oldest in the country in Los Angeles? And I was like, yeah, because I was like, I thought for a second, I said, and they said, would you like to move to California? And I thought of that Zeppelin song, and then I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I want.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I want to move to Los Angeles.
And a guitarist with stable income, right?
Yeah, and not only did I have concert income, now I had real stable income from teaching.
And for me, like, I've managed to maintain, like, I was all classical from when I started, you know, assistant Cincinnati, I guess, up until... like maybe 2013 or something like that. Like, I do a little bit of pops. Like, I did a gig with the Beach Boys once and things like that. But
one of your first gigs was Air Supply.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. One of my first professional gigs was Air Supply. That's right. I totally forgot. That was like 96 or I can't even remember. that's a long time ago. And then in 2013, because what happens in the classical, and I love classical, like I still do a ton of classical. But in the classical world, there is this stigma where if you do pops or popular stuff, you're not legit. You're not a classical person. So if you lean too hard into the popular stuff, you don't get gigs as a classical conductor.
Same thing happens in classical guitar. When I started adding popular tunes or, say, jazz stuff, there was like, I remember just people would come to me at guitar festivals and they say, we've heard you've gone a little bit crazy, right? it's like, it was really, they were treating me like I had had a break or something, like a mental break or something like that, because I was playing She's Leaving Home. Right. It was a really weird conversation. Sometimes I would pretend it was true, but it was like, it was a weird... Classical people, it's better now, I would say. Wouldn't you say? But,
yeah. Like, what happens is I still get some guest conducting. Like, I have, and I've always had the security knowing I have my own home orchestra. Like, I'm under contract right now. I won't always have it, but I have it right now. So I would always get my classical fix there. But whereas I used to get called to guest conduct classical with other orchestras, you know, five, six times a year. That's maybe once or twice now a year. And I do get called more to do rock gigs, which honestly, I had to reach you get older, you get older. Mm-hmm. And you realize you're not going to be Herbert Von Karajan, but do you actually want to be Herbert Von Karajan? Well, maybe that's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. You think you might be Esa-Pekka Salonen or Dudamel, and then you realize, well, I'm not going to reach Dudamel levels, but what makes me happy? And as long as I have the intellectual satisfaction of doing a lot of the classical in my life, because it's trickier to do, and it keeps your mind very active. I actually enjoy the rock gigs, so I reached a comfort level within myself, whereas as long as I have some classical, I'm willing to be perceived as the rock guy, because as a conductor, there is that line that is still like, I can go do something amazing with an orchestra, but the second they see you do a rock gig somewhere else, you're kind of a rock guy. And it's a thing, there's an elitism to it that is that I try to break down. But it's as long as I can go on stage next week and do a Tchaikovsky symphony, and then the next week I go do our Phil Collins show, that to me seems like a very, and then the week after I do an all Gershwin show, you know. So there's that I've actually got comfort. I have no shame in the direction that it's taken. So,
but it seems to me that I keep on reading about orchestras that are having trouble surviving.
Yep.
And they have to actually go a little in the pop direction in order to attract people to their concerts.
I'll speak to this for a sec, because up in Canada, we've had a few fail recently. At least the model here in Canada, it's a tricky one, because if you go all pop, then you're not going to get the best players. Because they can go and play their Stravinsky's and things somewhere else, and people lose interest. Also, a lot of the donations and grants that are tied up in this, you're not getting it like in Canada, you're not getting a government grant because you're doing absolutely amazing Christmas carols. You're getting a grant because you're doing contemporary repertoire, classical repertoire, and you're judged on the level at which you do that. So if you remove classical from your model, you fail. But I have a board of directors who always says, well, we should do less classical. I go, okay, well, then say goodbye to that grant, that grant, grant, that grant. But yes, a successful orchestra finds a way for the popular part of their activities to help subsidize the classical part. And that's the balance that you need to achieve. And Cincinnati does this brilliantly. Cincinnati has done this so brilliantly. Their summer venue where the big rock bands come out, Riverbend, very quietly, nobody knows this. Cincinnati owns that venue. The Symphony owns that venue. So when you go to see Ozzy Osbourne in the summer, you're putting money in the pocket of the Cincinnati Symphony. It's absolutely a brilliant model. And
L.A. Phil owns the Hollywood Bowl. Did you know that?
Exactly, yeah. Ooh.
Yes, L.A. Phil owns the Hollywood Bowl, yeah.
So there are these things where popular music is a useful medium to help support the kind of legacy of the orchestra. I think, yeah, we have to, but like, and I look at hybrid programming, not only like what we do with Gravel Museum, but like in November, I'm going to do the Canadian premiere of something called the Queen Symphony. It was a piece that was written 20 years ago by a composer, an English composer named Tolga Kashif. And it uses Queen as the source material, but it's very much a classical symphony with full choir, Mahler size orchestra. And so there are, now I'm not saying that there's a lot of pieces out there like this, but I decided it was time to try and do that. So this season we've programmed this Queen Symphony, and it is bridging the gap in advance of the season because it hasn't opened yet. It's our best-selling weekend of concerts so far because it is drawing both the classical and the rock people. So there are these hybrid things that are possible.
I have this kind of like take on the whole when is rock mixed with classical acceptable? And I always go back to one thing, and that Christopher O'Reilly put out an album of Radiohead tunes, right? Christopher O'Reilly is a great pianist, and he put out this incredible album of his Radiohead arrangements, which took the source material really seriously, but then kind of gave it almost like a Keith Jarrett-y sort of take. And then there started to become like this acceptance. I said, well, Radiohead, that's high up, very erudite music. And then you do start to see like kind of like crossovers, especially in string quartets and everything that like, oh, Radiohead is okay to do, right?
Beatles is okay to do.
So there are these acts, like it's still not like Zeppelin. It's still not like, it's like where there's that certain elitism to it, but some people have broken through. And I would say like the Beatles and Radiohead are two acts that actually managed to somehow crack that barrier. Nick Cave is probably another one. I mean, believe it or not, I mean, there are a few that managed to crack through the respectability bubble in classical music.
And I just saw the legendary Kronos Quartet, who are an avant-garde string quartet ensemble. Okay. They only deal in like the most avant-garde, the most recent of music. And still to this day, their very famous arrangement of Purple Haze, they're still encoring that. They just encore. Arguably the most erudite chamber music ensemble out there. Yeah. And they have no problem with doing Jimi Hendrix as an encore. So
I think it just takes more people kind of thinking about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. So it is necessary, I think, for orchestras. And our shows tend to, like the ones that we write and we produce ourselves do tend to sell well because it's kind of like an open goal. I mean, it's like, Phil Collins and Genesis, it's Invisible Touch and Against All Odds. People still want to see that, or people still want to see Under Pressure and Stairway to Heaven. They like that's a no brainer.
You do have to be, though. And we made a few missteps because we thought what the first thing we did,
our first show was a misstep.
Because we look for holes in the market and, you know, because there's lots of people. So I said, but, you know, there's great Queen shows out there and there's great Zeppelin shows out there and things like that. So let's find. So we looked at Deep Purple and kind of that stuff. And I think we overestimated stepping into a territory that has not been explored, we thought, okay, well, that's fine. We'll own that space. But there's a reason the other acts hadn't gone into it, because there just wasn't as much prevailing interest in it. So I have to say that we have to be, we had to turn a little bit capitalist about this. You can't, and this is a wisdom of age, and I don't think it's compromised because we're still doing music we love, but you do have to say, as much as I love Meatloaf, is a concert of Meatloaf, Jim Steinman stuff going to sell? And when you take a look at the sales,
I'd say I don't know.
Yeah,
and just, I don't know, it doesn't work for me.
And I don't know is too risky when you're doing this, because when you're doing something like this, you need it to survive, and you can only afford one or two failures.
Just to let you know, this first show that we self-produced, that no one hired us to arrange, that we decided to do, was The Legacy of Deep Purple. We did some Deep Purple, we did some Whitesnake, but we really leaned into Rainbow. Now, when given their first big opportunity, first paycheck, he said, I got a good idea. Let's do 15 minutes of Stargazer.
And the thing
and
is,
it was fantastic, right?
I think for us, both of us, I mean, as much as that was probably a misstep, I loved every second of it, because when I think of those bands, and Rainbow predated my interest in rock music. For sure. I'm sure towards the end of the Joe Lynn Turner era, I was listening to them. But when I take a look at bands from that era, Rainbow's arguably one of the highest. And like, I can't stop watching, still to this day, I can't stop watching Ronnie James Dio videos. I can't. I am in love with Ronnie James Dio. I can't let my love of Ronnie James Dio dictate business decisions, because if we said, oh, we're doing a night of Dio,
no one's gonna come. Well, no, we won't be able to sell
the orchestra wouldn't buy it, but if for some reason the orchestra were crazy enough to buy that show from us, the 800 people who go would love it, but
yeah, they won't mind the other 600 empty seats. But yeah. That's not to be, I mean, it's not that he's not popular, it's just in the format of who is that crossover audience who's going to go into a symphony hall to watch an orchestra of people who aren't famous, right? Now, perhaps if there was a marquee singer or something like that, I don't know who, but say it was a famous rock and roll singer doing the music of Dio, it would stand a chance. But if you're just kind of honoring the music of Dio with solid professionals who put on a good show, it's not a guaranteed sell. So it's kind of, you have to.
Well, I always say, and you say that with the thing, but like in my mind, we have no proof of this, but like because I conducted an ERIE for a long time, where Pat Monahan of Train is from. And I think he sang in a Zeppelin cover band. So I went to the Erie Philharmonic once. I said, we should try and get Pat Monahan to come home and do some show. And as when we talked through it, we were like, Train can sell out hockey arenas. But I wonder if Pat Monahan's solo in the orchestra genre, because there's people who love that music who also aren't comfortable in the orchestra genre. And that's another thing, that's a barrier that we have to break down. There is this, I think that the orchestra industry has made people feel like they don't, who don't listen to Mozart and Beethoven, we've made them feel like they don't belong. You can't clap between movements. We've created all these rules that are designed to make people feel stupid when they come into the hall. That's what a lot of orchestras, that's one of our biggest missions right now, is to say, you can wear jeans and a t-shirt. You can bring your drink into the theater. And by the way, if you want to clap in between the first and second movements, we're not going to shame you. Just do what you want, right?
There's actually, I mean, here's something that a lot of people don't know. When Beethoven did his symphonies, his premiere, not only would they clap in between movements, sometimes Beethoven didn't even do every movement. He would do one movement and then do another piece. And then do the third movement. Like, he would do it completely out of order.
Yeah,
he'd split up. And so we created a bunch of rules in classical music that are fictional. It's I mean, I understand that there's an order to it, but it also does limit the enjoyment of it to a certain.
Yeah, and I think it more creates barriers. I think that the kind of the construct that we have is a very purist kind of thing, and I actually appreciate the purist aspect of it, but I do understand that that there has to be a concession. Because we've managed to make it so intimidating to people that the barrier isn't price and the barrier is not the music, because the music's like music. If music is still being played at 200, like you can, no one can name me the hit song of 1905, but I can name you like some of the best tunes from 1805 and, you know, Beethoven 5, blah, 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 1805, 1806, right? And that has survived for over 200 years. Why does that survive? Because it's just better than everything else. So the history is the arbiter of taste. History decides what is good and what is bad.
We're still listening to the Beatles.
Yeah. Yes.
Listening to Elvis.
Yeah.
These are objective. We're still listening to Robert Johnson. These are objectively good things.
Yeah. History filters out the bad stuff. And we can say, oh, what I listen to is the best music. But we'll be dead before we actually know what was good. Because only the good stuff survives. And they go, oh, well, they're just marketing. Well, we'll have to see. Because if I'm trying to think of somebody who's really, oh, okay. Do we know if Taylor Swift will be around in, should Taylor Swift will have an amazing career until she dies? Like she will. There's no way she doesn't end up like, you know, Neil Diamond still playing when she's 80, right? That's going to be a career, but it's going to be the 100 years after that determines the legacy, and that none of us are around for that. We've cultified that experience in the concert hall. We shouldn't make a Beethoven symphony like going to church that you don't know the rules.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Okay. So this has been great. It's been a great education for me. And you guys are a lot of fun to talk to. I hope we can do it again sometime. But last question for both of you. And I think this is very appropriate because you not only have your careers as kind of employees of the symphony and the university, but also your entrepreneurs as well. So it's two different mindsets. What is the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way? Steve, let's start with you.
Best piece of advice, and it's simple it's very simple. It was by a classical guitarist, my favorite one, David Russell. He's a Scottish classical guitarist. And back when in my formative years, I would travel the world to do master classes with him in workshops. And there's one class I was doing with him in Chichester in the south of England. And we were playing something and I was playing some Bach thing. And then he asked me to change something. And I was like, and I kind of did it, but I then the second time through I just ignored it, right? He said, why didn't you do it? He says, I didn't feel like maybe it was right for me to do it. And he says, never ever sell yourself short, right? And that's it. That's the one thing, and it's the one thing that sticks with me, is that don't sell yourself short, because you can't. It's not a very profound thing, but it's true. It's a good maxim to live by. So it's just like, am I happy with my career? No. So don't sell yourself short. Do something. Right. And it's like, and I'm not like this big giant A type personality that's always out looking for the opportunity. But I think that taking reasonable steps towards making sure that you derive some sort of satisfaction is important. So I try not to sell myself short. That's it.
Great advice. Brad, how about you?
Well, I'll do this in two, because I did not have, coming up as a conductor, I didn't have the most supportive environment. My teacher was a sociopath, but I'll tell good advice I can impart after this. But can I curse once?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because whenever I would go on stage or be on my way to an assistant conductor audition, he would either call me or he'd be backstage. And before I walked on stage, he'd go, don't fuck up. which is so bad. But like in the back of my head, I still have my staff tell me that before I go on stage. I'm so damaged by that. But I like the it for me, that's helped me focus. But what I would actually say, what I would like to do is, and just to any musician, doesn't matter what age, I get asked by, and I teach at the Royal Conservatory in Toronto as well. And I always give this advice to young musicians, that if the industry is broad enough, that if you believe in yourself and you stay in it, eventually everyone else will drop out and there will be a place for you in it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you decide to drop out, it's because you found something better for you. Because if you drop out, it means you found something else that you loved. So there's no shame in dropping out either. If you drop out, let it be for something you want. But if you hang in long enough, the other people will find things that they would rather do. The key to success in music is just believing in yourself and staying until it's there. And maybe it takes you until you're 35. Maybe you have to do tables at the same time. But if you have talent and you've had enough encouragement to believe that you could succeed, this is a likelihood that you will if you hang around long enough.
So it requires a really a very malleable sense of what success looks like too.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're like the 20-year-old that thinks that you're going to have hotels and, you know, planes, right, and that's the only thing you stick to, yeah, life might become a little bit disappointing. But I think that anybody who sticks through it enough is going to learn what success is and what success isn't. So,
yeah. Well, like they say, making a living is the new success.
Yeah. And I've got, I have to tell you, like, I again, I don't have the dude in my career. I've got an awesome life. I've got an amazing life. So stable and filled with music. There's not a single part of my day that doesn't involve music.
So. And we know cool people.
We
know very cool people. Like
I've got to
Steve, me and Steve Hacker was the biggest pleasure of my life. And sometimes you don't want to meet your heroes, but my God, you want to meet Steve Hackett.
Yeah,
I really do.
I've got to share the stage with so many of my heroes as a conductor. I think I got to share the stage, and this probably for the Americans not as relevant, but yeah. I grew up, both Steve and I grew up, arguably one of my favorite bands was Triumph, a Canadian power trio.
Sure.
And Rick Emmett was honestly one of my idols. And I got to meet Rick. Steve and I got to meet Rick when we were like 16 or 17 at a guitar festival. We got to share a stage with him. But in 2012, I got to conduct him in a show. And then since then, I've had conversations with Rick. I've been able to experience, like, to hang out backstage with the Beach Boys is really cool. Like, it's through classical music, I got to meet my rock idols. It's so great.
Yeah. Through classical music, there's a period of time where I would talk to and have meals with Andy Summers from The Police on a very regular basis, because he is a big fan of classical music and classical guitar. And he hung out with he decided to join the classical guitar circle in Los Angeles for a period of time. So he was at like all the parties, and it was just like really interesting. It's that's Andy Summers. And then it would just fascinating conversation. Brad got to meet him too.
Yeah, I did. He was great. And through conducting Nashville Symphony with Chris Bode, the jazz guy, I got to spend a weekend hanging out with Kip Winger. Like, it's like, and Kip is an amazing musician.
He's an amazing, by the way, amazing
and a crossover because he's great at rock and he's great at classical,
and he's got an ear that's incredible.
So I loved Winger when I was a kid, and then you meet him and you go, wow, I have so much in common with him because his love of classical is pure, and it's it's anyway, so and this career has allowed me to meet my idols sometimes, and it's cool. I love it.
I live in a great place in Los Angeles, and I play guitar. I mean, it's like there's nothing that's not guitar music all day. There is the teaching, but if you like the teaching, then it's fine. You know, and if you bring, I try and bring art to the teaching. You know, even if I'm talking about music history, I like to make it into a show or try and like engage with people on it, because, you know, playing guitar is just communication. Right. And if any communication about music is better than communication about anything else, I think, for me, I just the only thing I enjoy communicating to people in a broader sense.
Well, thank you.
I think that's a good place to stop. I hope we can do this again. This is a blast.
Have us on anytime. Yeah. We got millions of stories.
So. Okay, we'll come back. We'll come back to it at a later date here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So it was a pleasure to meet you both.
Nice meeting you.
Really nice meeting you, man.
Take care.
Take care.
Later. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.